I have you loud and clear.
Hello.
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 Welcome.
Science.
And that is to say physics,
medicine,
nature,
or
space,
time,
the brain,
life,
the universe.
This week, as genetic testing becomes easier and cheaper than ever before, I'll be investigating the good.
There's lifestyle and there's surgical treatments that are available that you will be guided by your genetic test.
The bad.
People are concerned that if employers have genetic information, they will use it in employment decisions.
And the unexpected.
Turns out, although I'm a very proud French Canadian, I'm barely French. I am actually very Italian.
As we start to probe the secrets of our own DNA and ask, should you get your genome sequenced? I'm Georgia Mills, and this is The Naked Scientists.
The Naked Scientists podcast is powered by ukfast.co.uk.
I'd be really interested to get a genetic test, yes, but I'd also be quite nervous about it. But yeah, I'd be really keen to get a genetic test.
No, not really. Just don't see the point of, you know, knowing what's going to happen around the corner. Sort of, you know, sort of take every day as it comes, really.
I think it would be interesting to get a genetic test. It could tell you a lot about yourself, and also that you could maybe plan for the future that way, so it could be quite interesting.
No, I suppose, because it might reveal certain things that I'd rather not know.
Yeah, definitely. I come from Lithuania, and you know, the ethnic group from that country is quite old. So there's a lot of mixture from different, you know, from Asia, from Northern Europe. So I just like to see what, you know, what the majority of my ethnicity is.
Ready or not, the genetic age is upon us. DNA tests are being used all over the world. By engaged couples seeing if they're genetically compatible, by migration services aiming to prove or disprove ancestry, and by health services to try and tailor medicine to your DNA. And now, direct-to-consumer tests mean we can, if we want, choose to take a peek inside our own genetic code. But is this a force for good, enlightening us about our health and showing us who we are? Or are we opening Pandora's box and learning things about us that we should be keeping hidden? I'll be investigating all the insights you can get from your own DNA, like your past, present, and future, and the legal and ethical questions that have arisen because of this. So to start with, what is DNA?
First and foremost, it's the molecule that is in every cell in our body. It's a code in some ways that codes for life. You know, how do we go from being a single cell to the multi-cell, complicated, emotional organism that's a human?
This is Patrick Short, a PhD student at the University of Cambridge and the Wellcome Trust Sanger Institute. We had a chat about the famous double helix DNA, with help from a couple of props.
We've got two ukuleles.
Because ukuleles and DNA, believe it or not, have something in common.
Yeah, so there's four bases, A, T, G, and C. So it's like the four strings on the ukulele. You can think of it as A, T, G, and C. And they combine in different orders to code for proteins, and also to, as an instruction manual, really to tell the cell what proteins it's supposed to make, when it's supposed to make them. As you can imagine, just like in music, there's a limitless number of combinations, right? We can do A, T, G, C, or we could do A, 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 T, G, C. You know, just like the strings on a ukulele, we can go on and on. Any song you can imagine, you could play. And that's DNA. That's part of what makes it so complex. There's limitless possibilities of how you could fit these letters together. So humans, for instance, we have about 6 billion A's, T's, G's, and C's all in a row. And so just thinking about that number and how many possible ways you could fit A's, T's, G's, and C's together. If you had a 6 billion notes to play on the ukulele, you could have quite a long song. So so there's a lot of information in there.
So I think that's one of the things that I find it quite hard to get my head around. So you have just these four letters. How does that actually become anything?
Yeah, so the most basic kind of building block of what a cell can do is produce proteins. And on the genetic level, the DNA turns into the proteins using something that we call the triplet code. So it's every three bases of DNA within a gene corresponds to a different amino acid. So you might have A, T, and G together that correspond to one amino acid, and you might have, yeah, G, C, T that together correspond to another amino acid. And these sequences of three DNA bases string together to become a protein. So we have machinery in our cells called the ribosome that assembles, that takes this DNA and actually assembles proteins out of it. So it's this triplet code that allows us to go from DNA to proteins, and then proteins do stuff in the cell. You know, they move things around, they control what a cell can do and how it can move around and those sorts of things. Yeah, so it's all there somewhere.
So this basic triplet code of three letters can be read by machinery inside the cell, which uses it to build amino acids, which in turn build proteins, which is eventually how we get from A, T, G, C to you and me. You get half of your DNA from your dad and half from your mum, who in turn got it from their parents, which is why it's such a powerful tool for looking at ancestry. But how do you actually look at your DNA?
Essentially, genome sequencing, which has become incredibly fast and cheap in the last decade or so, allows us to take the DNA that's in each of our cells, usually either blood or saliva, and systematically decode what is the order of A, T, G, and C, this whole 6 billion letters in each of us. And the way it works broadly is we take the DNA from the cells, we smash it up into billions of pieces, usually a couple hundred letters at a time. And they're really expensive and quite sophisticated instruments that are used to actually take fluorescently labeled bases and attach them to the DNA. And then a big camera, a high resolution camera, watches the whole process. So basically we get this pretty amazing image that's these letters being incorporated into the DNA. It's sort of like a copying process that we're watching happen. And as these fluorescent letters get incorporated, they're a different color. So A is one color, and G is one color, and C is one color, and T is a fourth. And so these high-resolution cameras pick up this copying process going on and then translate the colors back into the sequence. And then because it's a bunch of really tiny pieces, we then have to kind of assemble them back together into what is our 6 billion letter DNA.
And this technology has raced along at breakneck speeds from where it started.
The number that's frequently assigned is about $1 billion to sequence the first, that's a single person, and it took about 10 years. And today it's less than $1,000, and we're sequencing hundreds and thousands. And this is way faster than almost anyone anticipated. So we think of how quickly computers have gained in speed and also decreased in size, and genome sequencing has outstripped even that exponentially. So I think most people would not have even predicted we'd be close to $1,000 a genome, and some people think it's going to go down to 100 within the next 5 years. So it's quite a dramatic drop that's allowed us to do some amazing research.
As DNA testing gets cheaper and easier in future, we can start to understand more about ourselves. But by and large, exactly what each bit of DNA does is still a bit of a mystery.
So we're not even close to understanding everything, which is exciting because it means there's much more to learn. But it also means, you know, if you're given your genome sequence, it's almost impossible to tell you what that means from the standpoint of your risk for certain diseases. So there's a lot of effort in this area to kind of construct risk factors. You know, given your genetic background, how likely are you to have Alzheimer's or Parkinson's or cardiac arrest or those sorts of things? And we're beginning to understand how the genome turns into risk for these diseases, but we're really actually only just scratching the surface, yeah.
Patrick Short. If you want to get a genetic test, there are now companies offering this very service. These often don't look at the whole genome, but small relevant parts. So what can they tell us? Marco Naharis is a medical student at the University of Oxford who gave one a go.
I chose to get my DNA tested because I think it's just another health metric, just like knowing your body mass index or your full blood count. And it could tell me what risk factors I might have for certain genetic diseases, or what medicines might work better or worse for certain conditions that I might develop. And also because I did a research project on schizophrenia genetics and I wanted to know what my genetic risk factor for schizophrenia was. It was actually a really simple process. I signed up online and I received a pack through the mail. That included a plastic tube for me to provide a saliva sample, and I mailed it back. And in 3 months, I received my results online, and the service provided an interpretation for some gene versions, but I was also able to download my raw data so I could check it against my own research. I found out lots of really cool things, such as having some very distant ancestry from East Asia, Southern Europe, South Asia, and even the Middle East. And I even have Neanderthal DNA. Thankfully, I also found out that I don't carry any risk genes for certain conditions like cystic fibrosis, Alzheimer's disease, and Parkinson's disease. But sadly, now I've also found out why I'm so lactose intolerant and shorter than your average male at 5'7".
Marco Naharis here on The Naked Scientists. So Marco's test told him he had no risk factors for certain diseases. Always nice to know. But these tests can tell you some things you might be less keen to hear. If you had a crystal ball that would reveal your disease destiny, would you look inside it? A lot of people get DNA testing from professional health services for this very reason. They might have already had a disease and are looking for a genetic cause, or they might have a family history of a disease and want to know if they've got it. But this information can be a blessing or a curse, and equally it's not always clear what it means, which is where genetic counsellors come in.
My name is Jonathan Roberts. I'm a genetic counsellor and I'm a PhD student at King's College London and the Wellcome Genome Campus. Genetic counsellors work in hospitals alongside other health professionals, and it's a focusing on the supporting people as they go through genetic testing. So genetic testing can be quite a challenging process, both in terms of the amount of information you have to take on, but also there's an emotional aspect to lots of genetic testing. You know, it can be a significant piece of news. There's also a familial aspect, so it doesn't just affect you, it affects your family in lots of cases. So there's lots of other aspects that patients need supporting with as they go through genetic testing. Genetic counsellor's job is to do. I guess there's a number of areas that you can kind of split genetics into. One is prenatal testing. So this is when you're looking for the cause of a sort of developmental delay or childhood onset condition. So an example of this might be something like cystic fibrosis, you may have heard of. This is a recessive condition, so you have to have a copy from both mum and dad. And cystic fibrosis causes a lot of problems with things like breathing, and it affects lots of other organs. And you can test for that, and that can be very useful if you have a diagnosis for that in a child, in terms of allowing families to kind of make future decisions in terms of family planning. There's other stuff, things like cancer is a big part of genetic counsellor's workload. So the two most famous genes are probably BRCA1 and BRCA2. So Angelina Jolie made these a lot more famous when she had testing for BRCA1. And this was a gene that caused an increased risk of breast and ovarian cancer, as well as a few others. And it's not a certainty. So if you have an alteration in one of these genes, you're not definitely going to get breast or ovarian cancer, but it does lead to a significantly increased risk. And what you can do is you can have preventative measures, or so things like increased screening from a certain age, or if you choose to, risk reducing surgery, so say mastectomy, for example. But then there's lots of other areas. So cardiac genetics is something that's a growing area as well, and that's similar to cancer genetics in a way that often you're dealing with increased risks, and often your genetic test can lead to quite clear kind of treatment and diagnostic options.
I suppose if you're likely to have a heart attack, you can be like, well, I'm going to cut down on my fatty foods and do some cardio. There are some very clear cut things you can do about it. But there's also many conditions that we don't as yet know of any cure. And this could be something like Huntington's. So what happens if someone knows they're likely or definitely going to get something that we can't cure?
So Huntington's disease is a good example of something where there's no treatment for the disease. That you can treat the symptoms, but there's no way of halting the progression of the disease. That is a very challenging case for genetic counselling, because the primary focus then is allowing a patient to make the decision that's right for them. So actually, in the case of Huntington's disease, most people choose not to know, but there are some people who would like to know in terms of planning their life and knowing, having the uncertainty taken away. And it's about choice, and it's about control. And for some people in that situation, control is choosing to know, and choosing to plan their lives and choosing to have that information, and for some people, choosing is not to know.
Huntington's disease is caused by a mutation in a single gene, and if a test picks up the change we know is responsible, it's pretty much guaranteed you'll develop symptoms. But a lot of diseases aren't so clear-cut. Lots of genes might only slightly affect your chances of developing cancer or heart attacks, so this can mean the results of a genetic test aren't always clear.
So I think helping patients understand risk is a really important and quite challenging part of genetic counselling, because risk is something that can be explained in lots of different ways. So you can have a lifetime risk. So you might say you have an 80% risk or something over your lifetime. You might also explain it in a 10-year risk. So you might say, if somebody's 30, you might say in the next 10 years, your risk is this. When you're talking about those, you're talking about absolute risks. You're talking about the clear chance that something is going to happen. An example of an absolute risk is a coin toss. The absolute risk of getting heads is 50%. Then you might talk about relative risk. And relative risk is a bit more tricky because then you're talking about risk, one risk compared to another. So let's say your risk of something is 1%. And then it goes up to 2%. Now, you could say that that's a 1% absolute increased risk, but as a relative risk, it's doubled. So that means it's 100%. So when you're giving risk figures, relative risk can sound very scary because you might say your risk has gone up 100%. And actually, all it's done is gone up from 1% to 2%. So it's very important to be very clear and go through the risks in quite a lot of detail, because there's lots of different ways you can talk about risk, and that can be quite confusing and then quite worrying for patients.
Genetic counsellors provide this service to take you through these results. But you can also get some of this information from kits you can buy online. And there have been concerns in the past that some services might provide inaccurate results or fail to provide context or clarity. However, just this week, in a landmark ruling, the FDA, the Food and Drugs Administration, gave permission for home testing kit 23andMe to send people information about their risks of 10 diseases, which include Alzheimer's and Parkinson's, which means we're likely to see a lot more of these home testing services in the future. So can you trust what you see in a test you get online?
So it depends a little bit on what they're looking for. Tests can look for different things. One of the things they can look for is single genes that are the cause of certain conditions like early onset Alzheimer's or BRCA1 and BRCA2. What they do is they look for specific points in those genes, so specific genetic changes that they know cause those conditions. So if they find one of these genetic changes, that's a pretty clear result. That's going to be quite accurate. What's important with a lot of these direct-to-consumer tests is that they don't look across the whole gene. Very often, they're just looking for the particular points they know about. So if they don't find something, that doesn't rule out there being a genetic change. There could still be something. So this is what we refer to as positive and negative predictive value. So positive predictive value means, what's the chance of this finding being true? Is it real? And the positive predictive value of a lot of these tests is very high. But the negative predictive value, which is the chances, is this a real negative test? It can often be low. So that means there could still be a gene change that they haven't found. So my advice to those people who have those tests would be, if you have any questions, then you could, seek a referral and get professional advice, because it's important to understand the real meaning of these tests.
And whatever kind of test you get, Jonathan highlighted that it's key you know what kind of results you might get and making sure you really do want to know them.
What can happen sometimes in genetic counselling is if someone's got a result that they don't expect, that can often have a psychologically adverse reaction. So one of the reasons that we prepare people for different types of results is that it's helpful to think through kind of, how much of an effect that's going to have on your life. And what can really kind of hit people hard in terms of genetic testing is when you get a result and you just weren't expecting it. So that's one of the reasons that a lot of our focus is placed on trying to explain to people, kind of doing informed consent and allowing people to think through the implications of a genetic test.
And unlike other indications of your health, like your blood pressure or your weight, DNA is very different. For example, if you've got a gene for something, your family are likely to have it too. And they didn't get a genetic test, so do you tell them? Should you have to? It's an open question, but people are asking it in the courts.
A woman is currently suing a hospital for not disclosing genetic information. So her father had Huntington's disease, and for various different reasons, he decided not to disclose this information to her. And then she went and she had a child. And then later on, it was disclosed by accident by a health professional that the diagnosis was Huntington's disease. So then this woman Googles, as you would do, and then finds out this is inherited and it's untreatable. And she says she wouldn't have gone and had a child if she had known there was this risk in the family. She'd have had testing first. She had testing, and it turns out that she has inherited the HD gene from her father. So she is arguing that the health professionals had a duty to break her father's confidentiality and tell her about the genetic tests. And of course, this is difficult for the hospital because health professionals are so used to seeing confidentiality as this kind of sacrosanct thing. But in genetics, it raises a really important question of whose information is it? Because it's a piece of information for you, but it's also your family's information. So that's going through the courts. That's going to be a really interesting outcome in terms of healthcare practice and genetics practice.
The fact that DNA ties us together with our family is exactly why some people are interested in it, because as well as your possible future, your DNA holds the key to your past. Many online services claim to offer you clues about your ancestry. Peter Forster is a fellow in archaeology in Cambridge University, and he owns one such company, Roots for Real, which people use for a variety of different reasons.
For example, there are some people who don't even know who their parents are, adopted children, for example. And for these people, we can tell them your mother's from China, your father's from West Africa, and we can do this using DNA tests. Going further back into time, some people have, for example, heard their ancestry might be Jewish some 500 years ago, and then you can also do tests and see, yes, do you have a maternal line, a mother's line, which is very similar to other Jewish people or not. And if you go back even further into the distant past, some people are interested, do I descend from, you know, a Celtic line which has been in Britain, let's say, for 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 years, or do I come from a Saxon line? And this is ancestry going back 2,000 years. And then there are those who want to go back tens of thousands of years into the Stone Age at the time when the continents were settled, and they want to trace back the history of how humans across continents are related. And so you have many different motivations, and this, as I have explained, translates into different timelines and different time depths that you're looking at.
I guess just, yeah, outline the process from start to finish. Someone comes to you and says, I want to find out all about my past. What would you do? How would you get their DNA, and then how would you look at the information in it?
Well, typically they'd order a test on our website, Roots for Real, and then my colleagues would send them a swab kit. So they swab saliva, they swab themselves and send the saliva back to us, and then we do DNA sequencing. And depending on what kind of test they ordered, whether it's a paternity test or whether it's a female or male line test, we then produce the raw results, first of all, in the sense that we determine the DNA profiles. And then subsequently, we would do the statistical calculation for this deep ancestry that would typically be database searches. And then we would email them, first of all, a result saying, this is our preliminary result. We think, you know, you have this type and you come from this part of the world and there are surnames such and such which match your surname possibly, or your father's surname whom you don't know if you're an adopted child. And then a couple of days later, we print the results and some explanations and send these results to the people who've ordered the test.
And so why would a string of DNA letters be different in someone from, say, Tibet, from someone from Wales?
This is actually the research that I'd been doing since the early 1990s as a student. And the answer to your question is 60,000 years old. That is when we calculated when humans left Africa as a small group, less than 200 people, and settled the rest of the world continent by continent, and arriving in Europe by about 45,000 years ago, Australia also about 50,000 years ago, then Native Americans arose from an Asian population about 20,000 years ago. And what creates these differences between humans on various continents and even within continents is not the fact that we've been separated for a very long time. If you think about it, 60,000 years, you know, is 2,000 generations. That's not a very long time. So the differences between humans are not that ancient. But what is crucial is that the founding populations for each continent were very small. So as I said, out of Africa, we had perhaps 200 people leaving. Into America, other groups have calculated 70 people are ancestral to all Native Americans today. 70 people, a founding population of 70, 20,000 years ago. So these are very small numbers. And because these numbers are so small, there is a huge opportunity for people to be different from their ancestral population because only a small part of the genetic variation has been carried over onto the new continent or onto the new island.
I see. So this very small starting population size mean that there's just a very distinctive genetic fingerprint, I suppose, in the different parts of the world that's still imprinted in us today.
Yes, that's exactly one way how to put it.
What about going even further back? Because I know some people have been delighted to find out that they're part Neanderthal. So how does that work?
Well, this goes back to a paper some years ago where researchers found that some of the DNA in Europeans and Asians seems to look very ancient. You find it's about 2% or so. You find it in Neanderthals, but importantly, you don't seem to find it in Africans. So those researchers offer two explanations. One is that people outside Africa are mixed with the Neanderthals, and therefore they have this 2% ancient DNA in their genomes. And the other reason they gave in the research publication was that there was no mixture with Neanderthals, but the Africans in the past 60,000 years, since we left Africa, have lost about a couple of percent of their DNA variation, which we outside Africa have retained. And that makes our 2% retained DNA look similar to Neanderthals. So those are the two theories. And the media, excuse me, of course, will go for the more exciting theory, which is to say that we are derived from Neanderthals in those 2%.
What kind of people have you had personally using your service?
Yes, so my first case was from the German police who had recovered a skeleton of a female from the River Main, which flows through Frankfurt, and nobody had been reported missing. And so they didn't know where to start asking questions, and they'd heard that I do these ancestry tests and asked me, could I take a look at this? My